Sairam, dear listeners, a warm welcome to this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth. Yes, we do need a warm welcome, for winter is slowly setting in here at Prashanti. But all the warmth that we need for this life and the life hereafter, may we seek it in the loving embrace of Bhagwan's love alone. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, the host for this show of Questions and Answers. On behalf of all of us, I offer my humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet before we begin our show today. Whenever Swami would bless a small group with an audience, he would always encourage them to ask questions. And Swami would be delighted to answer them. And do you need me to say that those answers were perfect, straight, and more importantly, perfectly customized for the person asking the question? For as it is said, a master does not answer a question, he always answers the questioner. Well, on Radio Sai Answering Booth, we don't claim to do anything like that. We only look for answers in Swami's message and we do it together. And in the process, we've done a lot of excavation, haven't we? And all thanks to the questions that you listeners have been sending me. We've covered quite a wide variety of themes. Well, this week's too, we will be discussing an important philosophical concept, and I'll try my best to make it as light as I can. But before we head to the question, permit me to share with all of you a short and interesting quote. These are words of the Clement of Alexandria, and I quote, "It is not your outward appearance that you should beautify, but your soul, adorning it with good works." It's a very short one, I'll repeat it again if you've missed it. "It is not your outward appearance that you should beautify, but your soul, adorning it with good works." End of quote. Well, there's nothing wrong in beautifying the body. To put forth a presentable appearance to the people we meet and move with is absolutely not wrong. But what really is wrong is the complete lack of proportion between the beautifying of our outside and the beautifying of our inside. Imagine you're going to cook a dish. You pick a vessel or a pan in which you're planning to cook this dish in, and you spend 15 minutes washing the outside of the vessel, and then you use it without washing the inside. Would any of us really do that? The functional part of the vessel is the inside. So nothing wrong in cleaning the outside of the vessel, and it must be cleaned, in fact. But the focus must be in cleaning the inside. So is the case with the human body too. We must maintain it in a presentable condition in the outside. But the real functional part is the inside. And how do we adorn it? How do we clean it? Through good deeds, says the Clement of Alexandria. But of course, we can add good thoughts and sweet words too. But how can we adorn the soul with what we do with our hands and senses? The soul is always beautiful. The Atman is divine, isn't it? Well, the mind on which we see the reflection of this soul is what is tainted. And the more we do good, speak kind words, and most importantly, think of God, who is purity himself, the mirror of the mind starts getting cleaned. And then it reflects the resplendence of the soul. Swami gives us the best way to synthesize this outside beauty and the inside beauty. When we care for the external body, can we make that also an act of service? When I speak with someone, I don't want that person to be troubled with my bad breath, isn't it? So I will take care of oral hygiene. My body odor should not cause discomfort to the person sitting beside me, so I deal with it. I should dress myself, Swami says, in a manner that is not too ostentatious for a simple person to approach me with a favor, nor should it be so shabby that an affluent person who needs help may keep away. In this way, Swami says, if we are able to maintain the external presentability also as a means of not making others uncomfortable, it will enhance our inner beauty too. And inner beauty keeps getting enhanced with every kind and noble word, gesture and thought. Before we head to the question that we have for this week, permit me, dear listeners, to read the quote by the Clement of Alexandria one more time. I quote, "It is not your outward appearance that you should beautify, but your soul, adorning it with good works." So let's head to the question for this week. And those of you who were with me the last week, I had a question from Ms. Praveena Kilpati, one of our regular listeners. And that question had in it actually four questions. I had the opportunity to answer the first two or the first half of that question. So today we'll try to answer the remaining part of the question. So what I'll do probably is start by playing the question. I've played it, the whole question, the last week itself. But let's listen to it again. As I said, there are four parts to it. Let's listen to all the four parts and then we'll proceed to the answer for this week.
Sai Ram, this is Praveena from Delhi. I have two questions. My aunt and I were discussing this last week. The first question is, as we take birth to live out our karma and our prarabdha in our current lifetime is predetermined, are we then born with a certain guna combination or do our thoughts and actions influence our gunas? And what about the role played by the three doshas? The second question is about realization. Is there a difference between self-realization and God-realization? Swami has said that when you get Sakshatkara, you do not live in this body for more than 21 days. But many realized souls like Raman Maharshi and Ramakrishna lived way beyond that. Could you please share your thoughts on this? Thank you. Sai Ram.
So as I mentioned, we answered the first part of that question last week, and it was quite an intense session, I should say. It was about the three gunas, the influence of the gunas on our actions and decisions, and is there a back influence, that, meaning that do the gunas change based on the actions that we perform and the choices we make? And of course, the other question was on the three doshas which are a central theme in the study of Ayurveda. And we spoke about those two, and the question for this week, or the part of the question for this week we're going to deal with, has got, again, two parts to it. One is God realization and self-realization one and the same? That's one question. And the other question is, what happens, the broader question is, what happens to one after self-realization or Sakshatkara or Samadhi or whatever you would like to call it? Actually, each one of it has a different meaning. We'll come to that. So those are the two questions. So we'll start with the first question, which is God realization and self-realization one and the same? The one word answer from what Swami says is, and what the Vedanta stands for, the answer is yes, it is one and the same. In fact, this is the very basis of a lot of things that we study in spirituality. Swami would say the paths are many, but the goal is one and the same. And Swami would say that you may follow any path. You may follow the path of bhakti, which is devotion, the path of jnana or self-inquiry. You can follow the path of karma or enlightened action. But the goal is one and the same. So if following all of these paths, you're actually heading to the same goal, it only means that the processes may be different. You may call it self-realization, you may call it God-realization, but what it leads to is the same. So the ultimate stage of realization is one and the same. So when we, for instance, let's take the path of bhakti, when you say that you start loving God and you try perfecting your bhakti, right? That's what we try to do in the path of bhakti marga. Or when it comes to the stage of inquiry, where you inquire into your own nature. Swami would say that you start ruminating over this question of who am I, who am I. The point of realization is the same. And this is the basis of Advaita itself, right? In fact, the central phrase of Advaita, which is given by Adi Shankara, and Swami would also quote this statement many, many times. And that phrase is Brahma Satyam, Jagan Mithya, Jivo Brahmaiva, Na Aparaha. This is the statement which Adi Shankara writes in one of his works, which is supposed to be the central theme of the Advaita Vedanta philosophy. And Swami would also often quote this, as I said. Now, what's the meaning of this Brahma Satyam? Brahman or divinity alone is real. Jagan Mithya, the world is an illusion. It appears real, but it is not. Right? Jagan Mithya. And the most important is Jivo Brahmaiva Na Aparaha. The point that's most important for our discussion is the jiva or the individual soul and Brahman or the divine soul or the divine super soul are one and the same, right? And this is the central theme of Advaita. So going by this, whether you're approaching realization as God realization or you're approaching realization as self-realization, I think it's one and the same. And in fact, taking it forward from what we were speaking last week, right? The whole discussion last week, or rather the explanation which I gave about how the unity became multiplicity, right? How creation came to be. That itself suggests that that's one of the most important points about the Sanatana Dharma or the Vedic approach to creation itself. It is not that God created the world. It suggests that a part of God became the world. So there's a lot of difference in that. When you say God created the world, you're talking of God being the creator and the creation being separate. But we always speak about a part of the God becoming the world itself, the creation itself. And when I say part of the world, what I mean is what the Purusha Suktam says, you know. These are the lines which Swami would very, very often call our attention to. What the Purusha Suktam speaks about as the process of creation. It says, Purusha evedagum sarvam yat bhutam yatcha bhavyam. Meaning that God is everything that is seen. Sarvam kaluvidam brahma. The other dictum from the Veda Swami would quote that everything that is seen is God. What is, what was, and what is going to be. Everything is God Himself. And it goes on to say, Padosya Vishwa Bhutani Tripadasya Mritam Divi. Which means, from one quarter of that glory of divinity, all of that which is manifest and that is seen as creation has been created. Three-fourths of that glory, I think it's a fraction which has been used to suggest that what is unknowable through the process of our mental exercise is so much more than what can be known. So this beautiful imagery of one-fourth the glory of God becoming all that is creation and all that is seen, and three-fourths of that divinity being unmanifest, that Swami would refer to that as avyakrita, which is unmanifest, which is not approachable through the mind and the intellect. Which means a fraction of divinity is what has become all of this, right? So whether you are going to look within and say, I want to understand my own nature, or you're going to look at the Creator and say that I want to understand the Creator or understand or approach the Creator, the process is going to be the same, right? And as we discussed last week, what is the process that happens? The quality of sattva, the guna of sattva, stirs this absolute and produces this maya, the illusion of multiplicity, the illusion of separate existence, right? So there are two paths available: either start adoring the Creator and understanding Him better, or look within and try to understand yourself better. And Swami would say the first one, the path of bhakti, is probably like that of a salt doll which is trying to measure the depths of the ocean, right? It eventually dissolves and becomes one with the ocean in the process of trying to explore the depths of the ocean itself. The latter path is, Swami would say, like breaking of a pot. You have a pot, there is atmosphere inside the pot, there is atmosphere outside the pot, and there is no difference between the two. What is creating this illusion of difference is the pot itself. So when the pot itself breaks, what is inside merges with what was outside, which is actually never separate at all. So this pot, the breaking of the pot, Swami says, is the breaking of the ego, or the breaking of the body consciousness, right? And when either one of it happens, Swami says, the multiplicity vanishes. It's not just that you understand that you are one with God. You understand that everything that is seen is also one with God. It does not have to, you don't have to deal with multiplicity one by one, as Swami would give. Probably an example which I can give is that of, you know, when you flash white composite light through a prism, it forms this spectrum of seven colors. So if you want to get rid of all these colors, you don't have to deal with them one by one. You remove this prism and all the colors vanish. You don't have to remove the colors one by one. Same is the case with this. You know, Swami says that the divinity shines through this ego, and you see this multiplicity. The moment you remove the multiplicity, all the ego vanishes, right? In fact, even a better analogy than this, and this is an analogy which Swami himself gives, and it's so very beautiful, I thought I'll share it here. Swami says that when you go to a cinema hall, you have this wide screen, and you have a projector room. I think, I don't know what is the technology right now being used, but this was how cinema was shown in cinema halls for a very long time, where you have a projector room and you have a small hole on the wall. The light is shined through the small hole. The rest of the hall is so dark, and the light is shined on this wide screen, and that's how we see the movie being projected and we can see the movie, right? So Swami goes on to say that this light, when it is shined through the small hole or a small slit in the wall, then you see all of these characters in the cinema. You see these villain and the hero, and all of these various characters are seen on the screen. But Swami says you're able to see that because the light is coming through only that small slit or hole. The moment the light starts flooding this white screen, let's say all the lights in the cinema hall comes on, or you don't project it through this hole, but you know the wall itself is removed, then you don't see anything. All the characters vanish and only the white screen remains. Swami says, similarly, your knowledge, your understanding, your perception, all of these, Swami says, which is actually the divine effulgence, all the knowledge comes from divinity, right? And Swami says, when all of these shine through this small slit called the ego or the body consciousness, you see many characters. Once this ego is removed, the knowledge shines so bright that the various scenes and characters all get washed into one indistinct shine of light, right? And that's the very, very beautiful thing that Swami says. And of course, it reminds me of that very beautiful incident that Professor Venkatraman would often share with us when he was doing a question and answer show, which is actually a very, very popular show. Those of you who are interested in understanding some of these esoteric concepts, I think should go and listen to that show or go and visit our website, the Spiritual Question and Answer series. It's a very, very beautifully conceived and very well presented work. Of course, Venkatraman sir does not need my certificate for that. He is what he is. He's brilliant, right? So when he was doing the show, there was this question which came to him, a very interesting question, that can an atheist attain sakshatkar? Can an atheist attain self-realization? So this was the show that, this was the question that he got, and he was answering this question on the show. The interesting thing was, this was I think sometime in 2007, 2008 or 2009, I'm not too sure. Swami was sitting in Yajur Mandir. Those were the days when after the evening darshan or after the morning darshan, Swami would listen to Radio Sai for a few hours when Swami had the time. So that time when Swami was listening to Radio Sai, this particular show was being broadcast. And Professor Venkatraman was giving a very scholarly reply to that question. One of the brothers who was serving Swami, Brother Satyajit, was there then. And he was listening to this whole program and he got this idea. You know, here is Swami, and who can answer this question better than Swami? Why not ask Swami himself? So he turned to Swami and he said, Swami, is it possible for an atheist to attain Sakshatkar? And Swami's straight, simple answer was, yes, why not? Why can't an atheist attain Sakshatkar? And Swami went on to explain that when whoever sheds body consciousness, dehabhimanam, whoever gives up, dehabhimanam tyajiste, that's what Swami said, whoever gives up body consciousness can attain sakshatkar. And of course, in another discourse, Swami completes that thing. Swami says it's not only about giving up body consciousness, but it is also about inculcating universal consciousness. So even as the body consciousness is given, universal consciousness or atmabhimanam has to be embraced. And if one is able to do that, whether he is an atheist or a theist, he'll be able to reach Sakshatkar. And I think this is a very important point that Swami is making, because when you're talking about self-realization and God-realization, if we were to really compartmentalize that and say that one who is seeking self-realization does not subscribe to the idea of God being a separate entity, so what happens to his process of self-realization? Swami says, yes, he too attains the same state if he is absolutely diligent in his process, and he gives up this body consciousness and attains the atmic consciousness. The other interesting thing which I thought I'll share with you is in the approach of devotion, when you're talking of devotion, when you're talking about an embodied God, for all of us, you know, Swami is with us, and this process of trying to understand Swami is always constantly going on, though we know that God is not to be understood. I think long time back we had this beautiful question from one of the listeners on the show where the person asked, you know, we know that we don't understand Swami. We know that we can never comprehend Swami. But why is it that we still keep trying to understand Swami? It was a very interesting question, because the mind keeps doing its work. You know, even though you know it can't, the mind always tries to understand whatever it comes in contact with, because that's a means by which the mind lays claim over whatever it sees. Just like how, you know, you eat a good dish, and if you're a good cook, you immediately want to know more about that dish. You want to know how to cook that dish. Or if you're a singer, you listen to a song, you want to learn that song, because that's a way by which, by knowing it, you make it a part of yours. So in that sense, when we come to Swami, when we look at Swami, we observe, this process of trying to know Swami and know Swami better will be constantly going on, because that is the way the mind lays claim over this entity. And when we, with this background, you know, there is this beautiful statement which Swami would often say. He says that, when I'm with men, I'm a man. When I'm with women, I'm a woman. When I'm with children, I'm a child. And the most important line, when I'm alone, I'm God. So this is a statement which Swami would make, a very profound and very deep statement. Many times I would think about this and say that, what does Swami really mean by this? And during some days when we used to be sitting for bhajans in the morning, we know that Swami would come for darshan and Swami would take a group for interview. And we would be sitting in the bhajan hall, Swami would be in the interview room, just a wall apart, and Swami would be speaking to these devotees. There would be times when Swami would dismiss a batch of interviews, and before Swami calls the next batch in for an interview, there would be brief spaces when Swami would be sitting all alone in the interview room. The boys would be attending to Swami, will be sitting outside. The other devotees will be sitting outside, and Swami alone will be sitting in the interview room. And I would think that if at that moment, if you can go and peep inside the interview room, maybe that's when you can catch Swami as God, because otherwise all the time he's either with us, or he's with the devotees, he's talking to the ladies, or he's talking to the children of the primary school. We never get to see Swami as God in that sense, because Swami himself says, only when I'm alone, I'm really absolutely God. I mean, I might sound silly in what I'm saying, but I used to think that, you know, if you could just peep inside that interview room at that moment when Swami is all alone, maybe you can get a glimpse of the real divinity. But the problem is, the moment you peep in, you know, Swami is omniscient, right? The moment you see, Swami knows that somebody else is there. And the moment there is another person, you know, Swami says, when I'm with a man, with a man, I'm a man. So the divine aspect is actually curtailed. But the most important thing, or the spiritual significance of what Swami is saying, is as long as there is an observer, as long as you look at Swami as a separate entity, as long as you're looking at Swami with your ego, with your body consciousness, with this limited idea that I am so-and-so, I'm working here, I'm doing this, I'm so-and-so's son, I'm a director, I'm a, you know, vice president, whatever, with all that idea of what you are when you look at Swami. Swami says your observation will never be perfect. In fact, there is this, it's a concept in physics, it's a concept in quantum mechanics, which was referred to as the observer effect. It may not be exactly what I'm trying to explain here, but they say that as long as there is an observer, the observed will never be absolute, right? And that is the same case with Swami too. As long as you are there as an individual entity, you're looking at Swami, you are not getting the perfect idea of Swami. So if you really want that sakshatkar as a devotee when you're looking at Swami, slowly this ego has to dissolve. And the day when this ego is completely dissolved is the time when you look at Swami and you can get the actual vision. So that is how this God realization, or that a devotee is aspiring for, or self-realization, which an Advaitin probably is aspiring for, is one and the same. The process is same. The ego has to be shed. The ego has to be sublimated. The body consciousness, deha bhimanam, as Swami said, has to be given up slowly. But that this is not, I mean, being a devotee does not excuse you from this. Being an Advaitin does not mean that you're going to eventually realize the same God, right? In another very, very beautiful story, which often I recall when talking about this devotee transitioning to that state of self-realization, is the story of in the life of the saint Namdev. I'm sure many of you would be familiar with that. It's a very, very beautiful episode where Namdev is probably a very evolved devotee. He reaches a state where he sees his Lord Vitala every day. He goes to the temple. He's able to converse with Lord Vitala. Lord Vitala comes to his house and, you know, he becomes like, he's supposed to be an example of Sakhya Bhakti. He becomes like a friend to Vitala. And he's able to call Vitala to his presence whenever he prays to him and he thinks of him. So he's in that state where his communion with God is so perfect, right? And that is the state in which Saint Namdev is. And the story goes that there is once a congregation of many of these great saints. So Saint Namdev is also one of them. The other saints being all the great saints of the land of Maharashtra. You have Gora Kumbhar, you have Muktabai, Nyandev, Sopan, Savtamali, Chokamela, and all of these people gather in this one place. And Gora Kumbhar, as the name suggests, is actually a devotee who is a potter by profession. He's a potter who perfects his devotion and becomes a saint. So the story goes that Muktabai, who is also part of that congregation, looks at Gora Kumbhar and says, you know, why don't you test all of us and tell us which of us is a really mature devotee, which of us is a complete devotee, and which of us is still in the process of perfecting our devotion. So Gora Kumbhar says, you know, I'm a potter, so I know only the ways of a potter. So he picks up that wooden implement which he has, which is like a small cricket bat, which potters use to see if the pot is completely baked. So he says that I will test with this. He goes around and he starts hitting each of these saints' head. And of course it gives out some kind of a sound, and he says that, okay, this one is a completely baked pot, this one is a completely baked pot. But apparently Namdev is a little disturbed with this approach. He said, we are not pots, you know, how do you test us by doing this? So finally Gora Kumbhar comes to Namdev and he hits him on the head. And to add to his discomfort, Gora Kumbhar says that this pot is not completely baked. And Namdev gets very, very upset and he says, you know, I thought this is a congregation of saints and you all seem to be such dalwits. And he gets very upset. He walks out of the meeting. Then he goes and he, as usually, goes to Lord Vitala. And Lord Vitala comes to him and says, what happened, Namdev? Why are you so upset? And he says, you know, this is what happened and, you know, they insulted me this way. So Vitala listens to him patiently and he says, you know what, actually you're an unbaked pot. So Namdev gets very, very upset. He said, you know, I came to you, I thought you're my friend and you also joined them in making fun of me. So Vitala calms him down and he says, no, it's not like that. There is a little more understanding that has to come to you. So he tells him that you go to this particular place. There is this guru, his name is Visoba Kechar. You go to him. He will tell you and he will give you that knowledge which is missing. And when you receive that, you will be complete. So Namdev, though he is not very keen, he goes to this place in search of this great saint, apparently, whose name is Visoba Kechar. And when he goes to that place, he finds an old man. He's pointed to an old man. They say that he is that great saint. And this man is lying under a tree. And to his shock and dismay, he finds this man lying down with his feet put on a shivalingam. A shivalingam is being used as his footrest. That's how the saint is sleeping. And Namdev goes and he starts shouting at this old man. He says, you know, how are you lying down like this? Your feet is on a shivalingam. Don't you have any sense of propriety? And this old man says, oh, is that so? I didn't realize. So Visoba Kechar looks at Namdev and says, I'm an old man. I'm not able to even move. I'm so tired. Can you do me a favor? Can you lift my feet and place it? And mark the beauty of the words that he uses. He says, can you place my feet in a place where Lord Shiva is not there? Instead of telling, you know, take my feet from the lingam and place it down, he says, can you place my feet in a place where Lord Shiva is not there? So Namdev, you know, goes and lifts this man's feet and puts it beside. And wherever he places that feet, at that point, lingam arises. And he lifts the feet of the old man again, puts it in another place, and wherever he puts it, you know, lingams keep appearing and it becomes this man's footrest. And that's when he, you know, he recalls the words of this man. He says, wherever Shiva is not there, can you place this feet? So the story goes, one version of the story goes that Namdev takes the feet of this guru, this great saint, and he places it on his own chest. And at that moment, this realization dawns that God is everywhere. God is in everything that is seen. And they say that Namdev's journey becomes complete. He gets that realization. So he goes back to his home. And this time he doesn't visit the Vithala temple because he's got this realization that God is everywhere. And the story further goes that Lord Vithala comes in search of Namdev. And he says, Namdev, what happened? Why are you not coming for my darshan? And then, of course, he explains. Namdev explains that, you know, Vithala, you've been cheating me all this while. You've been fooling me all this while. You never told me that you're in every being and every atom of this creation. So Vithala is very pleased. He says, yes, Namdev, you've finally become a baked pot. He says, your journey has been complete. And then he tells him that now that you have understood this, with this understanding, come and love me and teach others to love me the same way. So that is the boon which is given to Namdev. Probably I'll refer to this last statement that Lord Vithala makes to Namdev in the later part of the answer, but the explanation what I was giving so far is just that, you know, whether you're a devotee trying to reach that embodied God which you're worshipping, you're trying to perfect your devotion, you're trying to perfect your understanding of God, whether you're loving Swami and you're constantly thinking, you know, what does Swami expect of us? What does Swami want me to do? How does Swami want me to live my life? That itself is a process of trying to understand Swami better. Whether that is your process, or as Swami would say, you are sitting and asking yourself, who am I? Who am I? Koham, koham. To the point of reaching that idea that I am one with divinity. Or, as Swami would suggest, most of us do a combination of both, right? Swami has also taught us to do that self-inquiry. Even though we are devotees, Swami says that it doesn't mean that you should not do the self-inquiry. So whatever is the path, self-realization or God-realization, whatever is your goal, it's one and the same. Now coming to the next part of the question, it's about this one particular point. I've heard Swami saying this, that once you get the realization, I don't know if it is Sakshatkar. Sakshatkar is a different concept. Samadhi is a different concept. I've heard this being told by Swami that when a person reaches that perfect state, he does not live for long. At best, 21 days is what Swami has said, that eventually that person dies. So the question is, how about saints like Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, Ramana Maharshi? We all know them as perfected beings. And of course, India is replete with such great saints and sages. What happens to them? And how is it that they have lived for so long even after attaining that state of oneness? So I think a couple of months back I had dealt with a question of what happens to a person after he dies. What leaves the body after death? And, you know, what happens after that? Why does the soul come back to a body? I had answered that question in pretty much detail in answer to that question. I'll take a few points from there and start from there. And speaking about that, I spoke about the concept of the three bodies, which is again central to Vedanta, where the body that you and I see of each other is called the gross body, the body which is made of the flesh, the bones, the blood, and all of these physical entity. It's called the gross body. Then there is the subtle body. The subtle body is made up of the senses, the intellect. When I talk of senses, I'm not talking about the sense organs, the senses, and the intellect, the mind, and the subtle aspects of the human creation, and the pranas, the most importantly, the panchapranas. All of these constitute the subtle body. And then there is the third, which is called the karana sharira, or that which is the causal body. It's referred to as the causal body, which is the purest of all of these three. And when a person dies, as I was explaining in that answer, the first thing that happens is the pranas are withdrawn from the body, and that's how the body becomes a corpse, right? The pranas are completely withdrawn from the body, and the senses are withdrawn into the subtle body. The senses are withdrawn into the subtle body, the mind is taken into the subtle body, and this is the time when the subtle body depending on the actions of that present life, either goes for a brief period into the state of heaven or the state of hell. The subtle body goes, and you know, the subtle body going to the heaven or hell is akin to when we are asleep, we dream. That is similar to the subtle body going to the heaven or hell. So after that brief period of living out the merits or the sins of that lifetime, the subtle body, they say, is withdrawn into the Karana Sharira, is completely withdrawn into the Karana Sharira, and this state is similar to the deep sleep state, where you're not aware of that state, but it is there, and when you wake up, you're refreshed about it. So the story, the explanation goes that when you have karmas, further karmas to work out, when the Sanchita Karma or the complete bank of karmas is not completely used up, depending on the karma, the Karana Sharira chooses another birth, and again this whole process reverses. From the Karana Sharira, the subtle body emerges. From the subtle body, the senses and the pranas emerge, and they enter into the body, and then they animate this body, and the whole process happens, right? So this is what we had explained last time. So what happens when a person realizes in one's own lifetime, right? What do we refer to as realization? You know, when we talk of realization, all that we mean is this idea of duality vanishes from the mind. We are constantly operating in our normal life, thinking about this is good, that is bad, you know, this person, that person, and I am separate from this, and this is my family, that is, you know, all of that comes from the idea of delusion. So when you talk about realization, when you talk about Sakshatkar, what we are referring to is that vision of the oneness. The idea of duality vanishes. So the beautiful example which is often given to explain this concept of Maya itself is the concept of the mirage, right? When it's a hot summer day, you're driving through a desert or you're driving even through a highway, we often see this mirage of a water body in the far distance. So the idea of Maya is referred to as seeing the mirage. And when you attain realization, it is the understanding that it is just a mirage and it is not water, right? So Swami says that when you attain realization, when that idea of completely being sure that what I'm seeing is only a delusion, it is only a mirage, you stop running after it. You stop craving for it. Or you the actions that you would do when you think that mirage is water, you stop doing that, right? That's what happens. But even though you stop doing that, it is not necessary that the mirage itself vanishes. You know, now when we were children, we used to think that that's a body of water there, and when the car goes closer, we'll be able to splash across that water. But with experience, we know that that's not water, right? So when we know that, we are not going to be expecting that as we were expecting as a child. But it does not mean that the mirage itself vanishes. So that's what Swami says. When a person attains the realization that there is only one, there is no two, the duality vanishes, right? It does not mean that the mirage itself vanishes, which means he will still be seeing these different bodies. He will still be acting like a normal person. That's what Swami says. When you reach that state of realization, the mirage still exists. You will be acting like a very normal person, but you will be in a state where your mind does not ever dwell in the duality itself. And the other thing is, when I spoke about when does the soul enter a body? And whenever it does, from the Sanchita Karma or from that large bank of karma, what does it do? It brings a small part which is referred to as the Prarabdha Karma. The Prarabdha Karma is what attaches a soul to the body. As long as the Prarabdha for that birth is there, the soul is going to be attached to the body. So Swami says sometimes in the process of God realization, or in the process of self-realization, when this Jivatma attains perfection, when it attains the Sakshatkar, it will be in that state. It is referred to as the state of Jivan Mukta. Even when you are alive, you have attained that state of Mukti. So even though the mind has been completely sublimated in this process, that does not mean that the Prarabdha has been used up. So Swami says as long as the Prarabdha remains, this individual soul will remain in that body. So that could be days, months, years. It could be as long as that prarabdha lasts. And sometimes even though the prarabdha is used up, you know, you might even be, the soul might even be drawing more of the sanchita karma and trying to finish all of that. So that's why Swami would say many times when you're really progressing spiritually, you kind of tend to see more suffering in that person. It's not that it happens to everybody, but you do tend to see that phenomenon happening. So this is what happens sometimes. And the other thing which could happen, this is one of the cases which I said, that the mind is realized, but the prarabdha is keeping the soul to the body until the prarabdha is used. You know, that person remains in the body, but he's not attached to the body. He or she is not still dwelling in that duality. The other thing which could happen is, you know, when the Bhagavad Gita speaks of this state of samadhi, it uses this beautiful phrase. It's called sthita prajna, right? I'm sure you'd be familiar with that. The word prajna means integrated awareness, right? Prajna is the awareness of that oneness. And that's what is referred to as prajna. And when you say sthita prajna, it means one who is constantly in that awareness. The constant integrated awareness is what is referred to as sthita prajna. Which means, come what may, whatever be the situation, one does not change in that state of oneness. You're constantly in that state of oneness. Pain might come your way, happiness might come your way, but you do not for one moment swerve from that state of oneness. So when that is the case, sometimes Swami would say that even though you attain that state of realization, the individual might actually go through situations in life where this state is tested. This prajna is tested so that it is shown as sthita prajna. It is not just a flash of understanding. It is not a flash of realization. But it is a realization that is here to stay. That is what is called sthita prajna. So many times, you know, when one reaches that state through sadhana, through what Swami says, shravanam, mananam, and nididhyasanam, or through devotion, that state is sometimes tested through difficulties, right? And that's probably one of the reasons why we see many of these saints go through these ailments of the body. We know Ramana Maharshi had a cancerous growth on his shoulder, if I'm not wrong. Ramakrishna Paramahamsa had the cancer of the throat. We've seen many of these great saints go through this process where they suffer a bodily ailment, but they remain stable and, you know, absolutely unmoved through this. Again, I'm not saying that this is what they were going through. I don't think I'm qualified to say that, whether this was their state or this was not their state. So I'm just saying that this is one of the possibilities that happens. After you have reached that prajna, that prajna is tested, right? There's this very beautiful episode which they narrate about this great saint of the modern times, Nisargadatta Maharaj. One of the people who were there in his gathering, one of his disciples, they were saying that one day they were sitting around him. Typically his sessions would be like devotees would be around and they would be asking questions and he would be answering them. And he's, of course, a very, very pure Advaitin. So always he would be talking about awareness and consciousness and all that. So one day when this session was in progress, somebody from inside his house comes out and whispers something in the Maharaj's ear. And so he excuses himself, he just gets up, he goes inside. And after about a few minutes, he comes back, he sits on his chair and he says, okay, where did I leave? What was the last question that I was dealing with? And he continues speaking. Much later in the day, when they found out, they realized that actually Nisargadatta Maharaj's wife passed away. That was the news which was conveyed to him. And the way he went in and came out was so unremarkable that these people could not take it. You know, how can a person be so stable? And that is what it is when you talk about sthita prajna, when you go through life. Sometimes probably the jivatma itself is tested through the process of, you know, so a person may appear realized, but may be going through this phase where not only one is tested for oneself, but also as a sign for those around. You know, when people look, I would often think of this, you know, Ramana Maharshi spoke about giving up body consciousness. But if he had not gone through that phase where he was himself suffering this bodily ailment and he handled it with such divine grace and with such composure, probably his words might not have been so very strong to us. You know, when we see his life and we see his words, there's so much of experience backing those words that he says, when he says that you have to give up body consciousness and you have to transcend pain and suffering, right? So sometimes these divine beings, these saints go through this phase maybe to test their own prajna, or maybe to give us a glimpse of them being stitha prajnas, right? Going back to this thing of 21 days, the body being discarded, there are different states which I was telling about. You know, there are state, sakshatkar is one, then you talk about the different kinds of samadhi, savikalpa samadhi, nirvikalpa samadhi. Swami would often refer to the importance of not getting stuck in that savikalpa samadhi. I think in Swami's Jnanavahini, Swami speaks about that state of rasa aswadana, where you reach a state of bliss, you reach a state of ecstasy when you're meditating. And Swami says that that is actually savikalpa samadhi. That is the highest joy that you can feel with the mind, with the interaction between the subject and the object, right? And sometimes you get stuck in that state. Swami says that is savikalpa samadhi. For everybody who is watching that person, it might appear like a very, very great and very elevated spiritual state, which it is, but it is not the ultimate state. So Swami says that higher than that is what is referred to as nirvikalpa samadhi. And the word itself suggests vikalpa means any form of agitations in the mind is referred to as vikalpa. Any form, it is not necessarily the evil ones, even happiness, even compassion, even good thoughts, even noble feelings. Any movement in this, what is referred to as the manasa sarovar, the mind is seen as a placid lake. So any undulation on the surface of this lake is a ripple, right? And Swami says that that is what is vikalpa. And the highest is what we refer to as nirvikalpa samadhi, where there is no undulation in this mind at all. There is no movement. There is no angry, there is no desire. There is no ambition. There is no passion. There is nothing there. So in this state, Swami says that the soul is completely detached from the body. There is no necessity for it to hold on to this body. And that is when the body is eventually discarded, because there is no necessity to hold on to it. There is no need to still remain in that. In fact, I don't know if this is the right thing to say, because many times they speak about Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. One of the features of his life was he used to be very, very fond of food. And he used to be literally like a child, would be fascinated about some dishes. In fact, he would be sitting and giving a discourse very, very esoteric spiritual topics. And the first smell of the lunch being cooked, he would get up and he will run inside the kitchen just to smell the food, or just to put a morsel into his mouth. And then he'll come back and continue his discussion. And Shardama apparently used to tell him, why are you doing like this? What will people think of you? And eventually, you know, he gets this cancer of the throat and he stops eating, and he actually passes away about 8 or 9 days later. Many people refer to this actually as him attaining nirvikalpa samadhi and giving up the body, because literally he was holding on to that desire for food. That was what was keeping the atma with the body. And the moment that is given up, through this process of, it appeared like a disease, but probably this was the stage that he had reached. That's what they say. So in that sense, what Swami was referring to as after 21 days the body is discarded is this, that when the sadhaka reaches the state of nirvikalpa samadhi, there is absolutely no desire, there is nothing to achieve, there is nothing to do. In that stage, the sustaining of the body is not necessary at all. And in fact, in many of the Puranas, they say that sages who reach this state, their body is not in their control at all. They have to be taken care of. So their disciples would, you know, guard their body, because anything could make them shed that body. So this is one thing which is important. The other important point I'd like to make is the other possibility, because all of these is possibility. I don't think, unless Swami has said that this is the case with this saint, none of us can say that this is what they were going through. I think we don't have that authority to say that, but we can say that these are the different possibilities that are available. I spoke about the three bodies, the sthula sharira, the sukshma sharira, and the karana sharira. The karana being the causal. Again, this is a debate in different schools of Vedanta. Some schools of Vedanta acknowledge the fourth body, which is referred to as the mahakarana, or the supercausal. Some believe the karana itself is the Atman, which is divine. The moment the subtle body is completely withdrawn into the karana and it does not feel a necessity to manifest in a body again, they say that that is the ultimate, that is the ultimate stage, right? And when does that happen? As Swami would say, when there are no more desires, when the mohas are completely gone, mohakshaya is moksha, Swami would say. So when the subtle body is completely withdrawn into this karana sharira and does not find a need to manifest again, Swami says that, some people believe that that is the state of liberation. So this could happen at the point when the person is still alive, which is jivan mukti, or when the person is dead, which is referred to as videha mukti, where at the time of death, the body is discarded and the soul enters into the karana sharira and that's the end of it. But when you talk of the mahakarana, and this again goes back to what we were talking about, the Purusha Suktam, the 3/4 glory of God is remain unmanifest. What is manifest is only 1/4, right? So some of the schools of Vedanta speaks of it, and what is important for us is Swami speaks of it. So I think it is as good as valid. We don't have to wonder if anybody else gives validation for it. Swami speaks of the Mahakarana Sharira as one which is there. And this is that of the glory which is absolutely unmanifest. And the Karana Sharira is only a spark of that. So at this stage, some people believe that this Karana Sharira, when it has withdrawn everything to itself, is actually as divine as the Mahakarana, but it has the choice whether it wishes to manifest again in the human form or not. Even though there are no karmic deaths which make it manifest again, it might choose. They say that this Karana Sharira has the absolute freedom either to again manifest in the earthly plane in a human body, or it can go into the higher planes. It can go into the other lokas. That's what they say. So when we talk about liberation, when we talk about Sakshatkar, I think what we can understand is so very little from the possibilities which are there. The possibilities are so very infinite. And when this very absolutely pure being chooses to be born again for a certain purpose, it might be the purpose of leading people to the spiritual path. It might be the purpose of leading people to loving God. Maybe that is what is referred to as Karana Janmas. They come with a purpose. They do not have deaths which are karmic deaths which are making them manifest in the human body, but it is this purpose for which they come. And many times these Karana Janmas, they live out their purpose and they die. They might be living as perfectly realized, perfected souls, but they will remain as long as their purpose has to be lived out. So when we talk about great saints like Ramana Maharshi or Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, for all that we know, they might be souls such as these that have come for a purpose. They live out that purpose. They live out that entire period they've chosen to live, and then they withdraw themselves. So it has got nothing to do with what we refer to as Savikalpa Samadhi and Nirvikalpa Samadhi. So it is very difficult for us to say that this is what it is and this is not what it is, right? So that's what I wanted to say. And because when we talk about this Karana Sharira having this choice of going into the other planes, the Advaita Vedanta actually does not talk about it. It only talks about this stage being the ultimate of, you transcend birth and death. It does not make Advaita Vedanta any lesser in that sense. It doesn't make it incomplete study. I think with the faculties that we have in the human body, the intellect, the senses, the actions that we can perform, the karma, the bhakti, all of that, even if we are able to reach this state, I think that is all it matters. But when we refer to some of the Puranas, we often come across these stories of this soul becoming a star, Dhruva becomes a star, and one particular great saint becomes a servitor of Lord Vishnu in the Vishnu Loka, somebody becomes a Gana in the Shiva Loka. I think this is what it might refer to. When the perfection has attained, the Karana Sharira has attained that perfection and does not see the need to manifest the Sukshma Sharira again, probably it has this choice of going anywhere in this huge scheme of things, which we probably are not aware of. As I said, this cannot be told with much authority, and Swami does not speak too very clearly about it. There are hints here and there, but this is what it is, what happens when a soul attains realization. So that's the answer I wanted to give. I hope I gave something to think about and added some clarity to what on the question that you asked. Thank you, Sister Praveena, for asking those questions, 4 questions, and it gave us an opportunity to dwell into some very, very deep topics which is part of Swami's literature. As I said last week, this is the science, right? This is all the science behind spirituality. If you're a scientist, if you're having interest in science, you could go into all of this. But everybody can use the science in the form of technology. And what is that? Is what Swami teaches us. Be good, do good, love Swami, do seva. And all of that is actually the manifestation of this theory. So in that sense, if you're interested in the science, you can go back to the science and study it. Otherwise, Swami has given us everything in a nutshell, in a way that we all can learn. And I think we should be grateful for that. So thank you, Ms. Praveena, for asking us this question. I hope I did justice to the question that you asked. So with that, it's time for me to wrap up the show. I'm already running late by a couple of minutes. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining me. If you have a question on practical spirituality or very, very deep spirituality like the one which we had in the past couple of weeks, feel free to write it to me, and you can write in to prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. It's my personal mail ID, so if you want your mails to be confidential, you can be sure it is. And if you want to, if you wish to be anonymous, you can tell me. I will not mention your name on the show. Like Ms. Praveena, if you can send your question in your own voice, it would be wonderful. It's always nice to play a fresh voice on the show. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. I'm going to leave you with a song, just to give time for Bishu and his guest to join you for the last segment of the day, which is the Vahini Satsang. Do join me again next week at 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth.